Welcome to episode 10, or our DECA episode, as we don't like to call it. But we got a great one for you, starting with a good bad movie segment. We feature our first guest speaker on this show to talk to us about the movie Plan 9 from Outer Space, a very infamous bad movie. Following that, our usual trivia question, and then we'll have another Film Buffs Dictionary segment on another type of cut. This will be our third of three types of cuts that we'll be featuring. This one's the match cut. And then our top six list for this week, which is on slow movies. Now, lots of times we think of slow movies as being really boring. Here are some that are pretty compelling. Finally, we'll wrap it up with an installment in our continuing Best Of series, where we talk about movies from the 50s. I am Sam Stoddard.
And I'm Stephen Keller. And did you just demote me to guest star? Because I'm not going to live with that. That's not cool, man. What is this guest star business?
Well... This is a special occasion here on All Movie Talk because I'm going to introduce to you our first guest speaker ever. And it is, in fact, the person who taught me all about watching good, bad movies, Dave Parker. Hello, Dave.
Hey, how's it going?
Welcome to the show.
Hey, it's great to be here. Hey, but you know what they call me in France, right?
What do they call you in France?
Just take a guess.
All right, Le Dave?
No, not so much, actually.
Oh.
They call me Dave.
Dave.
Because that's my name.
Just Dave?
That's it.
Really?
Yeah, I don't go in for that, you know, metric system thing.
Okay. So what are you going to be talking to us about today?
I'm going to be talking about perhaps the worst movie of all time, the Ed Wood classic Plan 9 from Outer Space.
Plan 9 is that movie by Johnny Depp, right?
Something like that, I think.
Yeah.
I think he's in it.
I saw like a documentary about him making that movie.
So, all right, Plan 9 from Outer Space. This movie... possibly the worst of all time. It's really just unbelievably bad. It's one of the more famous bad movies, possibly from the episode of Seinfeld that it was in, where Jerry and George and Elaine are all going to go see this movie, a special one-night showing. As it ends up, of course, all of Jerry's friends bail on him, and he has to either go see the film alone or not see it at all, and he chooses not to see it at all because, you know, why? What's the point of seeing a bad movie if there's nobody around to make sarcastic comments to? And, of course, that's part of the... part of the joy of bad movies is talking to other people while you're watching it.
It's kind of weird how that works because in a good movie, you're supposed to shut the heck up.
It's definitely a completely different mentality when you're watching a bad movie than when you're watching a good movie. And if you go into a bad movie expecting a good movie, you'll end up being incredibly disappointed. But if you know it's going to be a bad movie and you want it to be a bad movie and it is a bad movie, then you'll just have a great time usually.
So here on the show, we're doing a service to our listeners by cluing people in. This movie they've heard about, Plan 9 from Outer Space, actually is a bad movie.
Who would have guessed?
Just as a quick synopsis of the movie, I'm not even really sure I can explain it because I'm not really sure the movie even knows what's going on. It has something to do with aliens coming down from outer space and like raising the dead to do something. Not really sure what the dead are actually supposed to be doing. They just sort of kind of wander around most of the time. And sometimes they karate chop people and they fall over. The aliens don't even seem to understand their own motivation half the time because sometimes it's like they're trying to contact the Earth people and sometimes they're just trying to kill them. Anyway, the movie opens with this guy named Criswell, who apparently was some sort of pseudo-famous psychic back in the day. He just is sitting in this desk in this room, and he's intoning about these future events that will take place, and he actually has this great line, "Future events such as these will affect you in the future." But then he immediately goes on to talk about stuff that happened in the past. Right away, you just have no idea what's going on.
I love, it might be the opening line, maybe the second line or something, but we are all interested in the future, for that is where you and I are going to spend the rest of our lives.
Yeah, and that's just one example of his spectacular dialogue. And he actually narrates most of the film whenever there's stuff going on that you can't understand, which is, you know, pretty much the whole film. He's right there to just confuse you more, I guess. But he ends his little spiel by titling the movie Grave Robbers from Outer Space, which is, of course, not the name of the movie. The story is that the local Baptist church apparently funded this movie. The legend is that, you know, they were offended by the title Grave Robbers from Outer Space, so Ed Wood had to change it to Plan 9 from Outer Space. That's not really the truth, apparently. It's actually probably more likely that Ed Wood just changed the title to try to pretend it was a different movie to avoid paying them royalties. So, not that there were going to be any, but... But it's just one of the many little legends that sprung up around this movie. The most famous legend, the opening credits list Bela Lugosi as a guest star. The legend is that Bela Lugosi was cast in this movie, shot a couple scenes, and then died during the production. And then Ed Wood had to scramble to recast the part, and he just decided to use all of Lugosi's parts anyway. And again, it's one of those things where the truth is actually a little stranger than the legend, because the truth is Bela Lugosi was dead long before this movie ever even started shooting. So all the scenes you see him in were shot for some other movie that he was going to do with Ed Wood, and they just don't fit at all. The movie opens with some old lady's funeral. It's Bela Lugosi's wife, I guess. And we get some more example of Criswell's wonderful narration where he says something like, "It's the sundown of the day, yet also the sundown of the old man's heart." It's
love that
just
line.
Terrible.
I also love the line, "The sky to which he had once looked was now only a covering for her dead body."
Yeah, that's an awesome line.
Now, wasn't there a stand-in to do some of that character's scenes?
Oh, absolutely. The part was recast with a chiropractor or something. The guy is like a foot taller than Lugosi, and he spends the whole movie with a cape over his arm and his nose in the crook of his elbow, trying to hide the fact that he's not Bela Lugosi, you know, and it's just terrible. We get a great scene after this in an airline cockpit. There's two guys basically just sitting alone in a room, and they have these cheap wooden yokes that are supposed to be like plane controls or something in front of them. This is the first scene where we get the UFOs. The UFOs fly by, and basically that's simulated by shining a giant light in these guys' eyes, and they sort of, you know, flop around like there's some turbulence or something. But they look out the window, and we get the first shot of the UFOs, and it's probably the worst special effects of all time, because it's not even hidden that these are just hubcaps on a string suspended in front of a painting of a sky. You can see the strings pretty much throughout the movie, but in this scene, you can see them absolutely perfectly. It's just a hubcap on a string in front of a painting, and that's it. So the UFOs, I guess, buzz a graveyard or something, and then they rise Vampira from the dead. I don't even know what this woman is doing in this movie, because every time she's on the set, I don't think she actually interacts with anybody. She just kind of wanders around, and they shoot her wandering around doing nothing. But apparently she kills some gravediggers, and so the old man apparently dies. We have this great scene next at his funeral where, like, 8 people pile out of this tiny little crypt and have some terrible dialogue in the graveyard.
A very cardboard-looking crypt, too.
Yeah, absolutely. The official Plan 9 graveyard set. It's filled with cardboard headstones and crosses that fall over when people touch them. And pretty much any scene with people in this graveyard, some actor will run into one of these props and will either knock it over or it will teeter. So the cops show up. Anytime the cops show up, it's this one shot of this cop car driving down a dirt road and sort of pulling over to the side of the road. It's the same shot every time. It doesn't matter if it's night or day. It doesn't really matter who's showing up. Sometimes it's not even the cops that are showing up. But it's always this cop car driving down this dirt road, pulls over to the side of the road, and then, hey, they're in the graveyard.
I think that's my favorite thing in the entire movie, that constant recurring shot of the car pulling down the road.
Yeah. So the cops all pile out, and we get Inspector Clay, who is this big, huge, bald guy played by Tor Johnson. I believe he's a professional wrestler, and he actually has only about 5 or 6 lines before he dies, which is a pretty good thing, because his lines are completely unintelligible.
He's like Andre the Giant without all the charisma and talent.
Yeah, without any charisma at all. Inspector Clay is like, "I will get Vona flashlights from patrol car." It's like, what? You'll do what now? So, I guess he goes and gets the flashlight. He wanders off in the woods and he dies, which is one of the saving graces of the movie, is that he doesn't have to say anything else, because, of course, he gets raised from the dead. So anyway, we get a scene of the pilot at his house, and he's telling his wife of his UFO encounter, and he tells her it was shaped like a huge cigar, and of course, it wasn't. It was didn't look anything like a cigar. It was a saucer on a string in front of a painting. Of course, the UFO goes over, and they all flop to the ground and sort of pretend like they were knocked to the ground by something.
It was a huge wind that they couldn't see.
Right, a wind they couldn't see, yeah, that's what it was. Of course, what else would it be?
I actually think it was just the actors kind of passed out from all the drinking of rye whiskey they'd been doing earlier in the day, and Ed Wood decided to put it in the script as being a UFO attack.
Absolutely. So anyway, the next scene is saucers flying around Hollywood and Washington, D.C. The Army has to shoot at the saucers, because that's what armies do in movies like this. And we have the scene with Colonel Tom Edwards, who is in charge of saucer field activities. So apparently the Army has an entire division in charge of shooting at saucers, which is some more really bad stock footage of armies on maneuvers, and then cut to our firecrackers going off around the cheap models of the, of the hubcaps on a flying string. It's really bad.
And the people looking up at it are not following the movement or anything.
Oh,
they're
yeah.
just kind of staring at the spot on the ceiling.
Yeah, there's just 2 people that look up at at nothing, because there's obviously nothing there. The army officer, Colonel Tom Edwards, tells us about how these saucers at one time attacked a small town, which is why they shoot at them now. Of course, you know, why they did this is a complete mystery, but, you know, he says, it's a small town, I'll admit, but nevertheless, a town of people. People who died.
And the colonel says, well, they must have a reason for their visits. And the guy asks, visits? Well, that would indicate visitors. It's like, yeah, maybe there's somebody in those flying saucers.
Yeah.
So why are we shooting them down again? Well, they couldn't do anything else.
Yeah.
Plus, there was that small town of people who died.
That small town that had people who died.
Oh, yeah, right. By the way, there was the small town.
So inside this wonderful space station, which is, you know, just a ball, there's basically just this one room, I guess, and it's got the leader guy just sitting at this wooden desk, and it's covered with this all, you know, 1950s random equipment to make it look futuristic. There's like an oscilloscope and a bunch of other crap. Anyway, we get our first scene with the main alien, whose name is Eros, and he is pretty much the most hammy over actor in the movie. Everything he says is just like he's giving the Gettysburg Address or something. The best part, though, is that the leader guy has this medieval sort of tabard on, and it's got like a battle axe in the front. And then we get one of the better scenes in the movie, and by better, I don't mean, you know, better, I mean worse. It's the great chase scene. The reason it's so great is because it's completely unintelligible. It cuts back and forth between three different actors when there's really only supposed to be two people in this scene. And it cuts between night and day several times. Basically, Bela Lugosi is coming out of the woods and he's coming into the cemetery. And it's the same scene we've seen before. But he walks out, holds his cape up, turns, and he walks back into the woods. And of course, that means he's going to go to the pilot's house and break into it, I guess. And he goes to the pilot's house, breaks into it. But when he's going into the house, it's Bela Lugosi. When he gets into the house, it's the other dude, the chiropractor dude. But the movie sort of misses the point with zombies, because if you've ever seen a zombie movie, zombies in ones or twos really aren't scary because they just wander around kind of slowly and they don't do anything. And of course, nobody ever seems to have the grand idea of running away from them, except for the pilot's wife. She's the one person in the movie who actually thinks, maybe I should just run from this guy who is just sort of lumbering around slowly. So anyway, this great chase scene starts where the woman runs out of her house. She goes through the cemetery like three or four times. It's the same shot of the same cemetery, and they just keep cutting back to it. Sometimes she runs through it one way, sometimes she runs through it the other way.
Right, she might have tried to run in the same direction the entire time.
And, yeah.
And then I love when they cut back to Bela Lugosi. He's in a different place.
Yeah.
Not only a different place, but it's daytime.
Exactly.
But the editing tries to make it look like they're all on the same path. And then there's the other question is, if you're going to run away from a zombie, why do you go through a cemetery? Wasn't there other destinations that might have been safer?
Exactly. And then there's this great scene where the woman finally decides running back and forth through the cemetery wasn't a great idea. So she runs out to the road. And of course, now it's daytime again, and she's running down the road, and this guy pulls up behind her. But, you know, it cuts back to Vampira and Clay and the old man, and they're at night. And then it cuts back to the woman at the car, and it's the middle of the day. And then it's Lugosi in the cemetery, and it's day. And then it's the old man coming up on the car, but it's night again. And then he gets to the car, and it's day. It just keeps going on and on like that. There's something like 9 cuts between night and day in this one scene, and it's just terrible.
Do you think possibly that we're actually witnessing a non-linear narrative in which Wood has carefully and skillfully crafted two different timelines together through the power of editing to make it seem as though it's one continuous story thread?
Yeah.
It's like Pulp Fiction.
Or Memento.
This is where Tarantino got the idea.
I think so, absolutely.
Dave, I think you're missing the point of this.
Yeah. I'm not really sure I'm with you guys on that. I'm pretty sure this is just really sloppy freaking crap.
You don't think then it's an example of the dialectic montage?
No. I think it's just really bad directing.
So let me jump ahead for you. There's this exchange after this whole cemetery chase, and these two cops are talking about it, and they're saying, well, have people really seen flying saucers or not? And one of the cops says, no, I don't think they're all just drunk or whatever. And the other guy, the detective, says, well, don't forget Mrs. Trent, and that's the woman who ran away, claims to have seen them too. She didn't have anything on her breath. And the other cop says, well, she was hysterical. And he says, well, true, she was frightened and in a state of shock, but don't forget that torn nightgown and scratched feet. And he goes, yeah, I hadn't thought of that.
Yeah.
I guess that's why you're a detective lieutenant and I'm still a uniform cop. I mean, you got to admit, the guy's powers of observation are great. He can look at a woman and instantly tell if she's wearing a nightgown.
absolutely. There's another great scene. They're talking about, you know, whether this was a saucer, and then they say, well, remember, you know, what we heard last time when we saw the saucer, and the other guy says, well, yeah, well, we heard the sound, but what about the light? And the detective says, well, haven't you heard? Many times a saucer hasn't had a glow or a light. And the other cop says, well, that proves it. You know, because that proves it's a UFO right there. I mean...
So the absence of a glow or light proves it's a UFO?
Well, the fact that there could be an absence, I guess. I don't know.
This movie has an interesting idea of proof, because if I can jump to the very end, Criswell comes back on the scene, you know, and he says, well, okay, well, that's what happened. Can you prove it didn't?
Yeah, can you prove it didn't happen?
I've told you all about these UFOs and undead zombies and everything. The burden of proof is on you.
Exactly.
That is an airtight argument. Nothing you can say against that.
Another great part of the scene where the cops show up for the, like the third or fourth time to the graveyard is they find an open grave, and while they're all standing around the grave wondering whose it is, the lieutenant looks around just sort of randomly and says, this spot looks familiar though. And of course it turns out it's Inspector Clay's grave, and they were all there just yesterday for the funeral. So that's kind of why it looks familiar. So anyway, there's another great scene here in the Pentagon where Colonel Tom Edwards gets grilled by a general. Are flying saucers real? And the colonel keeps saying, yeah, I believe they are. And the general threatens him with court-martial if he keeps saying that they're real. And then at some point, he just says, well, yeah, you're right, they're real. And then he goes and he plays him a tape of that they have of Eero speaking to them. And this tape is just wonderful because Eero speaks and he knows that there's a language difference. But I guess they've been waiting for the humans to develop the language computer so they can understand them. But at the end, we see that the aliens have one of these language computers, so why weren't they using it in the first place if they really wanted to contact the people of Earth? It's just inexplicable. So Eros is speaking on this tape, saying things like, it has taken you centuries to even grasp what we developed eons of your years ago.
Eons of your years. That's a lot of years.
It's eons worth of years. He also has this wonderful line in there where he says something like, with your ancient juvenile minds, you have almost stumbled upon an explosive big enough to explode the whole universe, which we are a part of that universe. At this point, I guess Eros goes back after he's failed. His leader tells him, this is what we're going to do. You're going to take the old dude, and you're going to send him in to somebody's house, and then you're going to use your decompose ray, and he'll decompose right in front of their eyes, and that'll really, like, make him believe we exist. Of course, I don't know what this has to do with anything, but we get a great scene at the pilot's house where they're just sort of talking about stuff, and then the old man shows up, and he just sort of totters into the scene, and they shoot at him a whole bunch of times, and then the aliens turn on their decompose ray, and he just turns into a big pile of bones. Of course, that doesn't really scare them all that much at all, and they don't really do anything that the aliens thought they would do, I guess. But they go off to try to find the flying saucer. So they get to the saucer, and they get inside, and there's this great scene where Eros is trying to explain exactly what they're doing. And of course, since I don't think the movie really understands exactly what the aliens are doing, Eros' explanation doesn't make a whole lot of sense either. But apparently, the humans are just really close to stumbling upon this explosive called solarinite. And I think it's supposed to be solarinite, because that's what one of the other people calls it, and every time I look it up anywhere, that's how it's spelled. But Eros seems to pronounce it solarbanite. His explanation of what it is that it explodes sunlight, which, I don't know, I guess it turns photons into little bombs or something. But his explanation is, imagine a can of gasoline, which is the sun, and then you spread the gasoline from the can to a ball, and then you set fire to the ball, and then travels back along the line to the can, and the can blows up, and the can is the sun. Like, okay, that doesn't make any sense at all. But
and the aliens are concerned because they don't want their universe's sun to blow up.
Right, because this
is... our one sun that serves the entire universe's worth of planets.
Right, this is apparently the only sun in the universe.
First of all, if you're afraid that somebody's going to develop this technology, maybe not the best idea to tell him about the direction to go in research, but I love his whole lead up to it. It's like, first year you got your firecracker, then you had your hand grenade, and then you had the bomb, and then the atom bomb, and then the hydrogen bomb, and there's only one explosion left, is what he says.
Yeah.
And the guy's like, well, you can't blow up sunlight. You can't see it. The photons are too small. And he's like, can you see or measure an atom? Yet you can explode one.
Yeah, and of course, one of the guys says, well, you know, what's so bad about that? Having a bigger and better explosion, you know, we'll be a stronger nation than before. And Eero says, stronger? You see? You see? You're stupid minds! Stupid! Stupid! It's just a great scene.
Well, he has some other answer in another part of that conversation where the people are asking him, well, why do you want to do all this stuff? And he's like, because of death!
Yeah.
Because all of you Earth are idiots!
Yeah. Of course, after Eros explains it all to him, what the humans do is beat the crap out of him and leave. Somehow, during this scene, the ship catches on fire, which doesn't make any sense because the saucer itself, after it lands, turns into some sort of shed. It's not really saucer-shaped at all. It's got ladders on the outside of it.
Maybe that's a giant cigar.
Yeah. Apparently, the saucer catches on fire, and the humans all pile out of the saucer, and we get this great end scene where the saucer is flying away, and it's really just a hubcap on a string covered in lighter fluid, and somebody lit it, you know, and it explodes, and that's pretty much the end of the movie. And it ends with Criswell again, as you said before, he challenges us to prove that it didn't happen, but he ends us with this great line, "God help us all in the future." Chris, we would want God to help us now, only in the future.
But the future's where we'll be spending a very long time, so.
Yeah, that's where
the rest of our lives.
That's where we're going to be spending the rest of our lives.
So we all have a vested interest in the future.
So it's a message movie, really.
Yeah. All right, well, for all of you folks who are just laughing hysterically along with us, Dave actually is an accomplished bad movie reviewer, and you should all go to rinkworks.com/badmovie. rinkworks.com, and we'll put a link to that on the website, but Dave has a whole bunch of reviews of bad movies like this one.
And it gets updated just constantly, too.
Right. It's a never-ending stream of updates.
Steven, would you like me to ask you a trivia question?
I want you to rock me like a hurricane with it, Sam.
Okay. Well, here is my rocking trivia question for this week. Who is the only individual to have won both an Oscar and a Nobel Prize? Okay, we'll check back with you toward the end of the show.
2 weeks ago, we talked about the jump cut, and 1 week ago, we talked about the smash cut. And this week, on our semi-regular Film Buffs Dictionary segment, we'll be talking about the match cut. The match cut is a type of cut that joins two shots together that are visually related somehow. A very well-known example of this is in the beginning of Stanley Kubrick's 2001 A Space Odyssey, where the prehistoric apes are just learning how to use tools, and one throws a bone up in the air, and the camera follows it up, and then there's a cut to a spaceship, and the view we get of the bone and subsequently the spaceship are about the same size and shape on the screen. So there's this visual connection between these two shots to reinforce the idea here, which is that the first use of tools in prehistory kicks off an arc of technological progress that ultimately ends in mankind building and using spacecraft. So just from this one example, we can see kind of the narrative power of using match cuts. It can tell a lot in one simple little moment that doesn't even have any words. Hitchcock was fond of using match cuts for dramatic effect. In the infamous shower scene in Psycho, for example, there's a cut from the circle of the drain in the shower to Janet Leigh's eye just after she's been killed. And again, the drain and the eye have the same size and shape on the screen. Or North by Northwest, Cary Grant and Eva Marie Saint are precariously perched on the side of Mount Rushmore, and he reaches down to pull her up, and there's a match cut to him pulling her up onto the top bunk in a compartment on a train. So one shot like that, kind of a little neat effect, and we suddenly cut out all this uninteresting narrative segments about how'd they get down off the mountain and what happened then and when they wind up on the train and so on. One of the most famous match cuts in cinema history is actually a sequence of several match cuts in a row. It's the opening of Citizen Kane, which shows a series of still shots of Xanadu, Kane's castle estate, and everything is still and fallen into neglect. And in each shot, there's one lighted window in the castle, and that window appears in the same place on the screen from one shot to the next, despite that the shots are all taken from different angles, and each one is a little bit closer to the castle than the one before and shows a little bit different stuff. So the effect is this great series of establishing shots that gives us a sense of where this movie is set, but also plunging us directly into the narrative by drawing our attention to what's going on in this one window where the first action of the movie will shortly take place. Now, all these are examples of shape matches, a type of match cut where you have one object of similar size and shape on the screen and you cut to another one like that. But there are other types of match cuts, too. On the television series Bewitched and I Dream of Jeannie, they served as cheap special effects. For Samantha or Jeannie to make something appear out of thin air, they'd have a shot without the object, and then everybody on the set would hold still while a stagehand would put the object in place, and then they'd shoot a subsequent shot. And by cutting the two together, it would look like this object appeared out of thin air. And, of course, the laugh track would then fire up at that point. Then there's also a kind of match cut where it's connected not so much with visuals as with sound. Again, going back to Hitchcock, in The 39 Steps, there's a famous scene where a woman discovers a dead body and she turns her head and opens her mouth to scream. But the sound that comes out is the whistle of a steam engine, and moments later, visually, we cut to the actual steam engine, which is what the next scene is all about. Spielberg kind of did the same sort of thing in reverse in The Lost World, where he cuts from a screaming girl to Jeff Goldblum yawning in a subway station with the sound of the subway rumbling by. So these are some examples of match cuts where the match occurs on the soundtrack rather than visually. By the way, last week when we talked about smash cuts, we also snuck in an example of a match cut. The old cliche where you show a killer swinging a weapon at somebody's head and right at the moment of impact, you cut to someone chopping wood or vegetables or something like that. These are smash cuts because they're designed to startle the audience, but they're also match cuts, cuts from one similar type of action to another. I guess you call those smash match cuts. So we're going to do a little demonstration of a match cut, and of course, again, we only have sound. We don't have visuals on an all-audio podcast, but I'm going to count to five. One, two,
three, four, five.
Well, Steven, how did I become you?
That's the power of editing, Sam.
Wow. Okay, that was neat.
Now you know, and knowing is half the battle. One of the great joys of watching movies is to see a movie that completely transports you to another place, that completely captures a mood and makes you feel as though you are part of something that you're not. That's the real joy of the movies. And I think few movies do it as well as slow movies, you know, long, slowly paced movies that really build a specific feeling, that they feel absorbing rather than fast-paced. And so today we're going to talk about top six slow movies that are still compelling. These aren't movies that are boring or even necessarily movies that are really long, but it's movies that aren't paced at breakneck speed, that take time to get to know their characters and develop a setting. And that's why we like them. So starting off, my number six pick is a character study from 1980. It's Martin Scorsese's Raging Bull, the great story of a boxer played by Robert De Niro and his difficulty in both life and in the ring and how he relates one to the other. It's a slowly paced movie. It's not that long, just a little over 2 hours. But it, for a boxing movie, it has to be the slowest paced boxing movie ever made. There are fight scenes, and the fight scenes are wonderful, but the rest of it's sort of this lingering, meandering retelling of this troubled man's life story. But it never feels dull for a second. It feels absolutely captivating, and in many ways, the scenes outside of the ring are every bit as exciting and compelling as the scenes inside.
Yeah, I didn't even think about that one when we went to compiling this list, because it doesn't feel slow to me in retrospect. I suppose it is when you're watching it, because it does take its time, as you say. But, I think most of these movies that we cover today are going to be ones that don't feel slow, because they sweep us away and make us lose our sense of time. My number six film, quite different. It's called Winged Migration, a documentary from 2001 about migrating birds. The plot development is a little slow, because there isn't any plot development. It's about an hour and a half of flying birds. It's slow even as a documentary, because there really isn't much narration to speak of, a few filler facts here and there, but that's it. But it's absolutely hypnotic. I've seen a lot of nature documentaries before. This one is in a whole different league. You see, for example, geese flying in a V formation, and one goose is flying right up and close to the camera as it tracks them, and the other geese extend off into the background. Lots of really privileged perspective shots like that that you maybe haven't seen before, however much you've watched the Discovery Channel. Gorgeous scenery of different types, including cityscapes. In fact, the movie was shot on all seven continents, and that gives the movie a real dynamic feel to it that prevents it from being monotonous, because it's always looking a little different from moment to moment. I'm not even a bird watcher. My parents are, and of course they love this movie, but I'm not, and I still find this a quite a beautiful experience.
How does it compare with its sequel, March of the Penguins?
Very different, actually. Very different.
Well, my top five pick is quite a bit different from your bird movie. It's Heat, the 1995 crime thriller by Michael Mann. Clocking in at just under 3 hours, it's a long movie, and again, as in Raging Bull, we have a great performance by Robert De Niro, but we also have Al Pacino as the co-star, as the cop who's trying to catch De Niro's classy heist man, and some other great supporting performances, including a real winner by Val Kilmer, I think, as an underrated actor. But the movie is not about heists so much as it is, again, about the people committing the heists, the worlds that they live in, and the way they relate to other people. There are a couple of really big action set pieces that are really great, violent and gritty and exciting, but most of the movie consists of a lot of talking and this cat-and-mouse game between De Niro and Pacino, and it all really culminates at the end. The final confrontation between Pacino and De Niro is absolutely stunning. One interesting thing is that the two of them are not in the movie together very much. They really only have two scenes, the climax and this really great scene where the two of them meet in a diner. Pacino knows that De Niro's guilty and is trying to catch him, and they just have this conversation together. And it's fascinating watching two great actors work, made more so by the fact that the characters have been so well developed.
Yeah, that's a great scene, very memorable. I love how in this movie, it really takes the time to show you the personal lives of all the different characters involved on both sides of the law. You don't really get the sense that these are the cop and robber, and nothing else defines them.
Right. Actually, what's kind of interesting is there was a bunch of stuff that was cut out of the script. It would have actually been longer had everything had been filmed and released, but there's an entire other subplot about Pacino's character being high on smack the whole time, and some other interesting bits that I think sort of like blurred the lines between cops and robbers, but I can't imagine it running even longer than it already does at 3 hours.
I put The Passion of Joan of Arc in my number 5 slot. It's a 1928 dramatization of Joan of Arc's trial and execution. Here's the plot. The judges say, "Do you renounce what you believe?" And Joan of Arc says, "No," and cries, and they kill her. This story is stretched out almost to 2 hours. And maybe for a lot of viewers it'll feel interminable, but for me, and certainly many people who have grown to respect this over the years, this movie is just so compelling and indelible, and I think solely because of how the movie is shot, almost entirely in close-up. We see such expressive faces in this movie, frowning, disdainful judges, and of course the anguished but resolute face of Joan of Arc, played by Maria Falconetti. It's sometimes said that movies graduated from being just a novelty with the introduction of the close-up, because on some level, what we're really interested in looking at it is each other, and close-ups give you an intimate view of other people in a non-threatening way. You can look at people's faces and eyes without being looked at in return, which you more or less can't do in real life. And this movie makes better use of close-ups than probably any other movie before or since.
Is it really 2 hours?
Almost.
Wow, yeah, I love the movie. In my mind, it runs about an hour. So that's I didn't realize it was that long. Well, my number 4 pick is another crime movie, and it's probably the definitive crime movie. It's The Godfather from 1972 by Francis Ford Coppola. And there have been a lot of mob movies made before and after this one, but this is the gangster movie of gangster movies. It's a long, sweeping epic, again, just about 3 hours long, and it takes the time to develop a story of a family and not just of bad guys doing bad things. We get to know every character in the movie. There are long, extended sequences where there are no crimes happening, and I think it's instructive that the movie opens not with a scene of violence or action, but on a wedding, and as it develops its characters, we see how they interact with one another, and as slowly violence gets added into the film, and in fact, it culminates in a very famous, very violent and showy and thrilling sequence, but for the most part, the movie is slow and about characters, and it's a hallmark of American cinema for a reason.
Yes, and again, I think you've chosen another title that is slow, but doesn't feel slow. My number 4, however, very definitely does feel slow, and it's probably going to be the most controversial pick here about whether it's even compelling or not. It's called Solaris from 1972 by director Andrei Tarkovsky. You may be more familiar with the George Clooney remake from 2002, which kind of had the power of the earlier movie, but not really. This is a tough one to describe. It's a futuristic story about a psychologist who is sent out to a space station outpost that's orbiting this strange planet where some really strange things are happening. People are seeing weird things. It sounds like the setup for an action movie spectacular kind of thing, but it's definitely not. It's more of a thoughtful, moody meditation about what makes human relationships meaningful. For instance, what if a loved one became manifest to you, but not really as he or she is, but only as you remember that person being, as you know that person to be? Would you be able to have a convincing, satisfying relationship with that manifestation? Or is there something missing from this scenario? Well, if you know someone really well, it might be difficult to identify any real problem, but maybe there is one, and this movie really explores human nature with that question. But it does so through building atmosphere and observing behavior rather than any sort of explicit narration, and that can make for a pretty slow movie. And Solaris is definitely slow, but for me, I think there's something incredibly compelling here that sort of sticks with you after it's over.
Yeah, and what about those great shots of traffic?
It's a great, great dramatization of what it's like to commute a long way into work in the morning.
You know, I definitely could have picked any number of Japanese movies from the 40s and especially the 50s, but I only want to limit myself to one, so I picked, for my number three pick, Ikiru, the 1952 film by Akira Kurosawa.
Very good movie.
I think it's my favorite of his films, and I could have picked a number of films by him or by his contemporary Yasujiro Ozu, but I'm going to go with Ikiru. It's the story about a man who finds out he doesn't have much time to live, and so realizes maybe he's wasted his life and wants to do something meaningful with his remaining time. And it's not at all the sort of cliched Hollywood version you might expect when you hear that setup. There's no, you know, no cliched plot lines. Everything doesn't work out the way it would expect to, and the movie's ending reaches a real sort of power, but it's quiet in a way. There's no big spectacular climax where he, you know, saves somebody's life or something like that. It's more quiet, and it's about how we can do small things that add up in big ways.
Ikiru is, I think, also my favorite movie from Kurosawa. For my number three, well, Sergio Leone's Man with No Name trilogy stars Clint Eastwood in three movies of increasing scope and length and willingness to take time to build atmosphere and tension. He followed it up with a movie that continues that trail, that same progression. It's called Once Upon a Time in the West, made in 1968, and despite that it tells an epic story, you could probably edit it down to a third of its length without dropping a single plot point. But that would ruin the rhythms here that are sometimes chillingly effective. This movie is all about dirt and menace and grit and ruthlessness, and it takes its time to let us linger in the feelings that these things create. We get a lot of extended close-ups of faces, mostly weather-beaten and grisly faces with mean eyes, and it gives us time to contemplate them and get a sense of these characters and the feelings they evoke. The first 10 minutes are probably the slowest. Basically, a number of grimy hitmen wait at a train station for their mark to arrive, and while they wait, they each engage in some little meaningless activity, like trapping a fly in a gun barrel and listening to it fly around inside, and we cut between close-ups of all these different characters faster and faster, and as I said, their faces tell their stories. Now, unlike Solaris, this is actually a real popular favorite, despite its slow pacing. A lot of people call this the greatest Western of all time, which I think is an exaggeration. I don't even think it's Leone's best Western. However, at present, it's the 24th highest-ranked movie, period, on the IMDb. So clearly there are people out there that love this, and certainly I do too. It's a compelling and pretty great and unique in a way.
Yeah, interesting that Leone made five films all about the West in North America, and he was, of course, an Italian. His movies about America and the Southwest are so definitive. I've always found it interesting the way foreigners can make such insightful movies about other cultures.
Yeah.
I think there's something about that. Well, my number two pick was not made by a foreigner, and I think that if you know me, it's not a big surprise. I had to pick it. It's 1994's The Shawshank Redemption by director Frank Darabont. It's a movie in which not a lot happens, which is why it wasn't necessarily a big box office hit when it was first released. In fact, it was considered sort of a flop. It's about a guy who goes to prison and then stays in prison, and there's some stuff that happens, but he does taxes for people and helps this crooked warden make money. And in fact, describing it in terms of plot, it doesn't sound at all compelling, which is, I think, why a lot of people didn't go out to see it when they first came out. It just seemed like a prison movie, and, well, no one knew how to advertise it. But through word of mouth and repeated showings on cable television, it's become a real classic from that era. It's fairly long, almost 2.5 hours. For most of the movie, we don't really realize there is sort of a plot running through the background, but we don't know about it. It's hidden from us, and the movie has some great secrets and surprises in store. But the final segment in the film, the very end, is done through voiceover and long shots, and a great final moment where their characters don't even say anything. It's just power through its atmosphere and its place and the character relationships it's already built up over the course of more than 2 hours.
You know what's funny about the end there is the end sequence of The Shawshank Redemption feels like the climax of a great thriller where the tension's really cranked and things are happening real fast and there's maybe not action-based, but certainly action going on. And there really isn't, is there? It just feels that way.
It's just two guys walking on a beach.
Right. Well, my number two pick is one of my wife's favorite movies. It's The Black Stallion from 1979, a movie that is so enchanting and evocative that it doesn't really feel as slow as it actually is. Again, like a lot of movies we've been mentioning today. It was directed by Carol Ballard, who would work with Animals Again in Never Cry Wolf, Fly Away Home and the recently tragically overlooked Duma. But this is his best movie, which, between a shipwreck and a horse race, might sound like a fast-paced adventure. Really just treats these events as incidentals, though, and the heart of the movie is the relationship between a boy and this mysterious Arabian stallion who slowly build up a trust with each other. The cinematography and the sparing use of sound are what really make it here. We get these great shots of, for example, an underwater shot of the horse swimming and close-ups of the horse's eyes and nose. It really makes the animal expressive, and the natural sounds help ground the images in reality and make them more convincing. And Ballard really understands something I think a lot of our directors don't, and that is that we perceive movies not in absolute terms, but in relative terms. So a movie that might have a rapid fire of one dramatic moment after another is not actually going to come off to us as powerfully and as fast as a movie that is sparse for a while and then pulls out fast, triumphant, dramatic moments. The Black Stallion is really great at this, I think.
Interesting. I definitely think it's interesting you describe those action sequences as being incidentals, because it kind of reminds me of my top pick, which may be my favorite movie ever, I'm not sure, but it's Lawrence of Arabia from 1962 by director David Lean, and it runs somewhere between three and a half to four hours, depending on which version of it you've seen. And it's the story of a guy wandering the desert during World War I, and there's no romance, there's no female characters pretty much at all. There are a couple of battle scenes, but they feel sort of incidental to the main plot, which is about a guy whose head we get into, but we always feel a little distant from him, and we kind of get to know him not through any personal revelations he makes. There's not a lot of time where he spends talking about himself, there's no interior monologues or anything, but we get to see how he reacts to events that unfold outside of him. And the other big star of this film is, of course, the landscape and the photography shot out in the Arabian deserts, and David Lean was an absolute master, perhaps the best at shooting epic films. And much of the movie features characters who seem like just dots in the distance, completely overwhelmed by this gigantic desert that just envelops everything. And I think in order for us to really appreciate where we are, it has to be a little slow, it has to take its time, and it definitely does that. And what's most memorable about the film isn't any one particular scene, but the overall sense of grand vastness that we get a good sense of the scale of things.
Yeah, and this is one where you do have to see it on, well, you don't have to see it on the big screen, because if you can't see it on the big screen, you should see it on the small screen just to see it, but definitely the big screen is important here. I like how you say it's all about getting inside this character's head, and yet you're still a little distant from it, because that's a hard thing to do when you think about it. I don't know what other movies do it. You definitely feel like he is this other strange person. Maybe in the movie you're like a servant or just a traveling companion or something, and the great man is here, and there's this sense of awe, and yet it's all about him, and we really kind of think we know what is going on in his head. It's a neat effect.
Absolutely. There's the sequence toward the end of the movie where he's been tortured. He's been tortured and humiliated, and we kind of break with him, and we're never 100% certain exactly how he responds. He's changed in some way, it's clear, after that. But we never really get a feeling of exactly how it's changed. And I like that, because a lot of biopics, I think, reduce their main characters into sort of a simple cliche stock movie character, and this resists that. Lawrence was not a normal guy, and the movie doesn't try to make him into one.
Whatever the audience can't understand doesn't make it into the biopic, in other words.
Usually, yeah.
Yeah. Okay, well, my number one slow but compelling movie is Tokyo Story from 1953. Also, we mentioned it's a great companion to Ikiru, mentioned earlier by Steven. But Tokyo Story is directed by Yasujiro Ozu. Again, this is a movie that completely, without filmmaking frills of any kind, tells the simple story of a family that's grown distant with one another. The elderly parents go to visit their grown children, and everyone is polite. Nobody ever really says anything aloud that indicates that something's wrong with this family, but through gestures and tones of voice and so forth, it becomes obvious to us that there's just this tragic lack of love that the children have for their parents. And the parents seem to perceive this as well and are anguished by it, but they never really say anything either. They maintain the facade, and their words fit the superficial conventions of polite conversation. So yeah, it's slow. There isn't really anything outward here in terms of drama, but there are a lot of long silences between words that speak volumes. And as I said earlier, by the end, I was just shocked at how emotionally moved I had become by this movie. Somehow it just really hit this terrible chord, and it's just so sad, but I think sad in a positive way, and maybe a way that urges us to examine our own lives. So this was a really personal, moving experience for me. I mean, I love my parents, don't get me wrong, but I think we can all use a reminder about what's important in human relationships sometimes, because we all kind of lose track of that at certain points. And I think this is one of the extremely rare movies that can actually help make someone a better person.
Yeah, I like the way that it focuses on stillness. Ozu is famous for this, and there's not a lot of movies that do that. When we think of movies, you think of moving images and sound and excitement, but Ozu is able to really capture times of quiet, and he's very famous for using those linking shots, exteriors, where he'll just, between shots or sequences, between scenes, he'll show trees blowing in the wind for 30 seconds a minute, and that's something that's done a lot in Japanese cinema today and ever since then, largely because of him, but it's so effective, I think. Between scenes where people have been interacting, we just get a sense of nature and stillness and calm that's all around us, and that's something that pervades all of Ozu's movies, and I think especially here. And I also like, you say it's sad and powerful, but not, unlike you think of a normal tragedy, there's no real cathartic scenes where the people shout out their feelings and frustrations. It doesn't give us the release that we would normally get. No one breaks down in tears, and because of that, I think it stays with us a lot longer.
Yeah, that's a good point.
Okay, so let's go ahead and wrap this up and review our top six slow movies that are still compelling. My number six, Raging Bull by Martin Scorsese. Number five, Heat by director Michael Mann. Number four, the great crime epic The Godfather from 1972 by Francis Ford Coppola. Number three, Akira Kurosawa's Ikiru. Number two, The Shawshank Redemption by director Frank Darabont. And number one, Lawrence of Arabia from 1962 by David Lean.
And my number six is Winged Migration, the documentary from 2001. My number five, The Passion of Joan of Arc by Carl Dreyer from 1928. Number four, Solaris by Tarkovsky in 72. And Once Upon a Time in the West by Leone in 1968. Number two, The Black Stallion, directed by Carol Ballard in 1979. And finally, number one, Tokyo Story from 1953 by Ozu.
We are up to the third in the Best Of series that we've been conducting lately, and this week we'll be looking at the best movies of the 1950s. Now, the purpose for doing this, again, is to give you some suggestions about some great movies to watch, and also to give you a sense of the chronology of film history. It is not for me to definitively say this movie was the best movie from this year. I'm going to be picking a best movie, but it's really my favorite.
But this list, I'd like to point out, this is an official list, and anyone who disagrees with it is subject to censure and fine.
Right, that's more or less what I was saying in different words.
Exactly.
Now, the biggest changes you see in film in the 1950s were mostly all brought about by television. Studios were afraid of television at first when it became very popular and widespread in the 1950s, so they started to change the way they did things in order to compete with it. Now, in 1951, for example, you see the introduction of widescreen, and that in turn ushers in the age of the epic, big, opulent, intricate historical dramas and so forth. The musicals get bigger too, and westerns start to become more socially conscious. Black and white gradually phases out, and color becomes the norm in this period. Film noir is going out of fashion. The last great one was made in 1958, and I'll mention it when we get there. And Italian neorealism comes to an end too, but the French New Wave is born right at the end of the decade, revitalizing France's film industry.
This is also the last real decade of the studio system, because it's weakening throughout the decade, and it's going to really be destroyed in the 60s.
Right. So in 1950, leaving off from last week when we stopped at 1949, the Academy Award for Best Picture was a race between two show business pictures, All About Eve and Sunset Boulevard. One was about the stage and one was about the screen. Oddly enough, the one about the stage won in Hollywood. It was All About Eve. I think it made the wrong decision, though. I mean, they're both great films. I would have picked Sunset Boulevard myself, and in fact, I am. But other great films are being made in this year as well, such as Akira Kurosawa's Rashomon, Harvey, the fantasy with Jimmy Stewart about his imaginary bunny rabbit, and also a crime film, The Asphalt Jungle, which is one of the early heist films.
I think probably one of the reasons that Sunset Boulevard lost is because it doesn't portray a very nice picture of Hollywood. Hollywood is not a good place in this movie. It's pretty spiteful toward Hollywood and everything that it represents.
Yeah. For that matter, All About Eve is pretty spiteful about the stage, so maybe that's why it won.
And, of course, it's not stage actors who are voting on the Oscars.
Right.
And Sunset Boulevard would also be my pick for this year.
So that brings us to 1951, when the Best Picture went to An American in Paris, the elaborate Gene Kelly musical with fantastic sets and really bright colors and great music and dancing. But it was a big mistake. I mean, it is a great film, but it's a little stodgy in places, and unbeknownst to the Academy at this time, they'd have a much better chance to award Gene Kelly the following year. But for now, 1951, we have a bunch of great movies made. Ace in the Hole by Billy Wilder, The Day the Earth Stood Still, a real cult favorite in the science fiction category even today, The African Queen, a very definitive pairing of Humphrey Bogart and Katharine Hepburn, A Streetcar Named Desire, which was an early great performance by one of the greatest actors, Marlon Brando. We also have A Place in the Sun by George Stevens and The Lavender Hill Mob, a really great Alec Guinness British comedy. My pick, however, would have to be with the old standby Alfred Hitchcock, Strangers on a Train. I just love this movie. It's very tense and suspenseful.
And don't miss the sequel, Strangers on a Plane, starring Samuel L. Jackson.
I bet he wanted those strangers off his plane.
1952, what do we have?
Well, that's a great year. But not for the Academy. The Best Picture went to The Greatest Show on Earth, which is frequently ridiculed as being not the greatest show on Earth. A little unfairly, I actually think it's a pretty good movie, but definitely not a great movie. It's a latter-day Cecil B. DeMille, not really an epic, but it's certainly a broad movie with a lot of different characters, and it's all about a traveling circus. But great movies that were overlooked, The Quiet Man, The Bad and the Beautiful, High Noon, Umberto D., the last neorealist film, and Akira, probably my favorite film from the director Akira Kurosawa, but it's narrowly eclipsed by my pick for this year, Singin' in the Rain. Remember I mentioned that the Academy could have waited a year and rewarded Gene Kelly for a much better movie. This one wasn't even nominated for Best Picture. It's a crime. This is arguably the greatest of all movie musicals. It's about the movies. It has such a great sense of joy. There's a real funny scene with Donald O'Connor, one of the great classic moments of comedy in all of film. And then there's just that iconic image of Gene Kelly singing in the rain and dancing and just having a great old time. You get the sense that if the policeman hadn't walked in at the end of that scene, that he just would have been dancing and singing all night just for the sheer joy of it.
Yeah, and Singin' in the Rain is one of my top five favorite films. It's a crying shame it didn't win, but like a lot of great, great movies, it took a while for people to really appreciate how wonderful it was.
Yeah.
So in 1953, did the Academy screw up quite as badly?
Not quite as badly. The Best Picture was From Here to Eternity, which is a really good movie based on a novel. Actually, the sequel is sort of weird. It's called The Thin Red Line, directed by Terrence Malick in 1998. And there's a third one, too, directed by who now? It's still in production. I think David Mamet was attached.
I don't know. I think actually you're directing it at this point.
I'm directing it. Oh, well, I'll be sure to do a good job.
Please.
Other great movies made this year were Stalag 17, The Big Heat, Ugetsu Monogatari, Roman Holiday, one of my favorites, The Wages of Fear, a really, really good French film at a time when great French films were kind of scarce until later on in the decade. But my pick is a film from director Yasujiro Ozu, a Japanese director that a lot of people don't really know about. He's highly acclaimed, but in very small circles. He's one to get to know. The movie is called Tokyo Story, and I think this is a candidate for one of the best movies of all time. A lot of, Citizen Kane is kind of the default choice. I think if you were to just say, all right, pick something else for a change, this would be in the short list that you might fill in. His films are very deceptively simple. His filmmaking style is pretty much no style at all. He just sets the camera down more or less at eye level, at least at eye level if you were sitting on a tatami mat, and basically he just watches the characters. You don't get a lot of even very tight cuts and stuff. He starts filming on an empty set and the characters walk in and then they leave and the camera lingers a while. All he's trying to do is capture some real life. He's photographing a story. You don't get the language of filmmaking sitting between you and the story. And in Tokyo Story, it's very subtle, but it's very sad. There's just an overwhelming feeling of sadness. But you come away from it, yeah, saddened, but not really depressed, because you feel like you've made a connection with a real situation and maybe even helped understand it a little better if it's something going on in your own life. I was puzzled by this at first, but the more I thought about it, the more I just really loved this one.
And I think it makes a really good companion piece to a movie you mentioned earlier, Ikiru, by Kurosawa, which is a
excellent companion piece. Both the same sort of feeling to it.
Right, and both set in Japan, obviously, and I think both expressed maybe what a lot of Japanese people were going through in the early 1950s. which should bring us to 1954, if I'm keeping my list correct.
Yeah, the Best Picture here went to a movie that was pretty timely at the time. It was called On the Waterfront by Elia Kazan. And this was a response to the Blacklist that was in effect at the time. As it goes, Kazan cooperated with the House Un-American Activities and received a lot of criticism for it. And this is his defense. Now, whether you agree with what he did or not, it's hard to deny that this is a great movie with a lot of power behind it. Certainly one of the best performances in the movies by Marlon Brando. Other picks for the best film of this year would be The Seven Samurai by Kurosawa, also La Strada by Federico Fellini, Sancho the Bailiff, and Sabrina. My pick, however, has to be Hitchcock again. It's Rear Window. I think it's his best film. It's a great thriller, but also says a lot about people and how we like to get our noses where they don't belong.
This is really boring that we keep picking the same movie, but also Rear Window, I think, is the greatest thriller of all time, and I would agree that it's the greatest Hitchcock. But, you know, going back to On the Waterfront, definitely a movie worth watching for a lot of reasons.
It's very close for me. That's a close race.
Yeah, but I was going to say that actually my favorite closeted defense of Blacklist activity is actually High Noon. So this should bring us to 55.
Yeah, in 1955, the best picture was Marty, the first independent film to win. In any case, other great movies made during this year were To Catch a Thief by Hitchcock, The Lady Killers, another great Alec Guinness comedy, East of Eden, one of James Dean's three very influential film appearances before his death, Mr. Roberts, Bad Day at Black Rock, and Rebel Without a Cause, another of James Dean's great films, Les Diaboliques from France, a great thriller, Rififi, a great heist movie from France, and Night and Fog. So, of all those great movies, Stephen, what's your favorite?
Probably Rififi.
Yeah.
Such a great, great heist sequence. One of the absolute
best.
Yeah,
it is. It's very good. My pick is One Froggy Evening by director Chuck Jones.
I thought we were picking features.
Oh. In that case, I think that Rififi and probably comes in a very close second, maybe it's first, depending on my mood, but I think I'm going to pick Mr. Roberts on that one. One of the greatest of all closing lines, among many other things.
All right, so Sam, tell us about 1956.
1956, the best picture winner is, I think, what my father's favorite film is. It's Around the World in 80 Days, and I think he loved that because he first saw it in the Cinerama format, where you have three screens that kind of curve around you and three different cameras, very all-encompassing experience, and this movie is not recognized as one of the great best picture winners, but I think it's unfair because for it to have its real effect, it has to be exhibited that way. It has to be seen that way because that's what it was made for. And on the small screen, it just does not have the same effect.
So Around the World in 80 Days in 56, that's an early Jackie Chan performance then, isn't it?
Yeah, very early. This was in the beginning of his career. He was not quite grown up yet, but he still knew how to beat people up. Other great movies made during this time, Giant, The Ten Commandments, The Searchers, very great John Wayne Western, Moby Dick, some good genre choices for this year. The Court Jester, a great comedy by Danny Kaye, Invasion of the Body Snatchers, a kind of an iconic horror movie, and also Forbidden Planet, also an iconic, in this case, science fiction movie. My pick for this year is a little film called The Killing. It was Stanley Kubrick's third feature and his first great movie, and it's about a heist, as a lot of my favorite movies are, actually, now that I think about it. But this one has kind of a documentary feel to it.
As we start winding this up, 1957, what's that bring us?
It was a great year for arty kind of flicks. 12 Angry Men, The Knights of Cabiria, Paths of Glory, Sweet Smell of Success, and Kurosawa's Throne of Blood. Also, two of Ingmar Bergman's best films, The Seventh Seal and Wild Strawberries. Also, for short films, What's Opera Doc? I have to mention that one, one of the great Bugs Bunny cartoons. The Best Picture Award went to Bridge on the River Kwai by David Lean, the first of his three main classic epics, the latter two being Lawrence of Arabia and Dr. Zhivago. My pick, however, is going to be Witness for the Prosecution, a Billy Wilder adaptation of an Agatha Christie story. It's a great film, some really great performances, and just a fun little mystery with a lot of great character moments and some twists at the end you will never see coming.
Yeah, I like Witness for the Prosecution a lot, but no way is it better than 12 Angry Men or Bridge on the River Kwai.
It's a personal choice, shall we say.
Okay.
Yeah.
Well, 1958, is your choice any less wrong?
Well, the Academy's was definitely wrong. It was Gigi, a musical that just took an untold number of Academy Awards. And actually, you know, it's okay. It's not that great. Better choices would have been The Defiant Ones, Ivan the Terrible Part 2 by Eisenstein, Touch of Evil by Wells. That's the last film noir I mentioned earlier, the last great one. And also The Hidden Fortress by Kurosawa that actually had a lot of the ideas that George Lucas took for Star Wars. My pick is Vertigo, certainly the most psychologically complex thriller I've ever seen. It's just amazing.
Vertigo, absolutely a classic. A lot of people erroneously believe it to be better than Rear Window. It's close, but not quite as good. Though I have a real preference for Touch of Evil. I really love it. Wells is such a gifted filmmaker, and I have a sentimental spot in my heart for the last of the classic noir.
Yeah, and it's nice to see Touch of Evil restored to his original vision.
Right, or as close to it as we can get right now.
Yeah, pretty close.
Our last year this week, 1959.
The best picture was Ben-Hur, a very notoriously big film in more ways than one. Other worthy nominations that year were Anatomy of a Murder and The Diary of Anne Frank, but the best films of 1959 weren't even nominated by the Academy. Yasujiro Ozu's Floating Weeds and also Good Morning, Howard Hawks' Rio Bravo, and here's my top three from that year, and it's very difficult to choose between them. Billy Wilder's Some Like It Hot, one of the great comedies, Hitchcock's North by Northwest, another one of his great thrillers, and François Truffaut's first film, The 400 Blows. I think North by Northwest is the film I like the best, but if I'm a little more objective, I think I have to give the edge to The 400 Blows. It's just a remarkably insightful study of adolescence, especially at this time in history when the movies hadn't really ever shown adolescence from this kind of perspective before, with this level of honesty.
Yeah, absolutely. I love Truffaut and I love The 400 Blows. But I'd like to mention Ben-Hur, which I think may be unfairly overlooked. You mentioned Around the World in 80 Days requiring a Cinerama screen. Well, I didn't like Ben-Hur that much either until I saw it restored in a movie theater, and it blew me away on a big screen. I think it's really difficult to judge some of these epics without having seen them in the theater. It definitely,
right.
When you watch it all in one sitting with that little intermission, and you see it big and a good sound system, a lot of people like to talk about how their nice widescreen HDTVs are as good as going to the theater, but I don't quite buy it if you're watching a movie like this. You still need a big screen, and it really helps out the film, I think.
Absolutely. So that brings us to the end of this portion of this series. Next week, we'll talk about the 1960s.
All right, sounds good. A lot of interesting films from the 60s and a really transitory period for the movies.
Steven, do you remember the trivia question that I asked you earlier in the show?
Yeah, I mean, it's totally stumped me, though. I have no idea.
Okay, well, the question was, who's the only individual to have won both an Oscar and a Nobel Prize?
Albert Einstein?
No,
Wasn't he in that movie IQ?
Yeah, but he didn't win an Oscar for it.
Well, he was robbed.
Yeah. Well, anyway, the person in question is George Bernard Shaw, who won the Nobel Prize in Literature for 1925, and then would go on to win an Oscar for the Best Adapted Screenplay in 1938 for adapting his own play, Pygmalion, to the screen. This play, of course, was later adapted to a musical called My Fair Lady.
Ah, yes, the Nobel Prize in Literature. How often I forget it exists. Real tricky, Sam.
And that's it for episode 10. But our website, allmovietalk.com, is only just getting going. We've got some great discussions going on there. We'd love to have you be a part of them. So go to the website, check out what's going on, sign up for a username, and post your comments. Let us know what you thought of this episode and what you're thinking of the show so far, and maybe even where you'd like to see it go. And also check out rinkworks.com, a good place for entertainment and movie-related features.
And be sure to check us out next Tuesday, 12/12/06. We're going to start talking about the Academy Award race. Who's hot to win the Oscars? Who's not? We're going to discuss it, break it down for you. We're also going to announce the start of something interactive about the Oscars that some of you should be interested in. We're going to talk about an interesting double feature that you would never imagine us pairing together. And our top six list will go along well with this week's top six slow movies, because we're going to talk about top six fast-paced movies. So see you then. And cut.